It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD from Slate, and I'm in for Tenzina Vega this week. The level of polarization in our country's politics can feel intractable these days, and the murder of George Floyd brought that divide to the forefront of conversations about race. While Black Americans and advocates for racial equity have long been aware of the role systemic racism plays across our country, there are many individuals who would prefer not to have these conversations, especially if these conversations are happening in schools. Across the U.S., more and more conservative lawmakers in states like Tennessee, Arkansas, and Idaho are advancing bills to ban the teaching of critical race theory. Though it's a decades-old concept, critical race theory has become the latest target of conservatives reluctant to discuss how our history of racism and inequity is still being felt today, including in our education system. We're going to talk about all of this and more with Matt Bachenfeld, a high school social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lizzie. Thanks for having me back.
And also with us is Gloria Ladson-Billings, professor emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and former Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education. Professor Ladson-Billings, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, I'm going to call you Gloria. Before we get deep into the conversation, can you explain what critical race theory is for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, as you said in your introduction, it is decades old. We're talking about 30 years of legal research that is a constellation of theories designed to explain racial inequity. When you begin to see patterns of behavior, social scientists want to know, how do we explain it? It's not just random. So it is a set of theories that suggest that racism is essentially normal in our society. It's not aberrant. It's not isolated incidents. It's those things that are in some ways baked into the way we do our governance and living. And on almost every measure of social welfare, we can see it.
Why do you think conservatives and some others have seized on this kind of language right now?
Well, I do think it is a bit of a dog whistle. Clearly, it was sent out there by our former president. Before that, no one ever actually uttered critical race theory outside of the academy. And once Donald Trump said he wanted to, quote, ban it. Now, think about that. A nation that talks about free speech and free inquiry wants to ban a way of thinking about something. But once he said it, it became a kind of rallying cry. And I think that it just what we're seeing is, as you said in your intro, a continuing polarization. So it becomes one more thing around which to rally.
Matt, tell me about the type of community you teach in and what you teach your students about race.
I teach in what I guess I would call a purpling city on the edges of Indianapolis. And so it's historically quite conservative and the county is still quite conservative. But the city of Fishers itself is kind of undergoing this demographic shift that is sort of changing a whole lot about the city. And so sort of to answer that shift, we've been trying to make sure that we are having honest conversations about race. And so in my classroom, what I try and push back against is what I call the spaceship theory of racism. So to describe what that means to us, a lot of folks treat racism like if you just rounded up all of the really overt racists in the country and you put them in a spaceship and you blasted them off to space, that you would fix the issue. And so the problem is stemming from like this 1% that are overtly racist and throwing slurs around. What we're trying to do is, I think what James Baldwin asked us to, he said the problem is deeper than we think because the problem isn't us. So racism is not best expressed through overt racists at all. I actually would argue that it's best expressed by looking at housing, employment, education, people's experiences with criminal justice and policing. And so when we talk about race in my class, we teach that our kids are learning on the edge of what was a sea of sundown towns. Sundown towns are towns that Black Americans were not allowed to be in after dark. Mm-hmm. And those are surrounding us in Indiana. Just because they have sort of their formally illegal does not mean that you don't see the remnants of it all around us. We teach about segregation in education. Right now, as we speak, our public education system is as segregated as it was in 1980. you know, the nation's and really the world's eyes were on Minneapolis. I would point to Minneapolis's public schools as a better way to understand racism. That city is 65% white, but only 35% of their public school students are white. Why won't white parents send their kids to public schools in Minneapolis? That's true sort of everywhere you look. It's true here in Indianapolis. You know, we
sure,
look
it's
at,
true here in New York where I sit. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we look at redlining. We actually took students through like a Google Maps tour to chart the redlining through Indianapolis. And we talk about what Eddie Glaude calls the value gap. The value gap is, I guess, the best way I could describe it very, very briefly. I'm 27 years old. And if you look at white 27-year-olds in America, according to Pew, about 6% of them grew up in impoverished neighborhoods. So that's not a typical experience for white 27-year-olds. When you isolate black 27-year-olds, 66% of black 27-year-olds grew up in an impoverished neighborhood. So how can that be maintained in a nation that says that it prioritizes equality? I think we would argue that we're apathetic towards that reality.
When you teach these things in your classroom, do you get a backlash from parents or from your students?
So I'll start with students. Students are so eager for these conversations, and that's true regardless of their political background. So it's not like this is dividing in the classroom along political lines where liberals want to talk, but conservatives don't. No, kids want to have the conversation. They're eager for knowledge. They want to understand why our city looks the way it does. What I would say specific to my classroom, I don't get a lot of pushback from parents, but that's because there is a face to the conversation. There is much more pushback at sort of like the general system, this fear. Mm-hmm. People think teachers sort of come from this shadowy area and they're here to indoctrinate children. But with individual teachers, they're not as likely to make that accusation.
Gloria, when you hear Matt talk about his experience and that split between, hey, I know my kid's teacher, and, well, wait a minute, what's this system doing to my kid? How common would you say that experience is?
I think Matt is right. You know, is spot on in what he's sharing with us. And I wish more teachers would be willing to do the things that he's doing. When I can have the students at the university level, what I find is a tremendous amount of anger because no one taught them these very things. They say, hey, I'm smart. I'm in the top 10% of my class. Why didn't I know that? Why didn't I know Wisconsin had sundown towns? Why didn't I know that Wisconsin is considered the worst place to raise a black child? Why, you know, how can these patterns of behavior or patterns of outcomes and results exist without a deeper, more systemic explanation? So I don't think that that our young people resist wanting to know this. They want an explanation. And unfortunately, what we have, and I'm not even saying parents so much as it is as organized opposition that then riles up parents to tell them, this is a very bad thing. You don't want your kids to know this. But it's very hard to look at what happened. We all had to literally watch the 8 minutes and 46 seconds or 9 minutes and 26 seconds, as we later learned in the trial, of a man die. And parents had to respond to kids and said, why is this happening?
Matt, when kids come to you and you teach high school, is this the first time that they are reckoning with these concepts, or is it something that they've encountered earlier in their education?
It's not the first
time. And I should say, I guess, white kids, because obviously yeah. Kids of color have already dealt with this.
That's where I was going to go. So I'll focus on white kids. I mean, what I would say is that students tend to have had shallow level conversations. And they tend to think that they understand some issues, and then they come to class and are shocked at the level that this is sort of seeped into the fabric of society. You know, what I tell my students, though, there's this great fear in the community that we are teaching white kids to hate themselves. what I tell them is like, oh my God, if you walk out of this class and you feel guilt, you've missed the point. You know, I tell them like, this is the house we live in, but it's not the house we built. We don't have guilt for the past. We do have responsibility for the future. And that's what we're trying to teach. But there is this incredible fear that we are actually engaging in this process of, to be honest, there are shades of replacement theory, this idea that we are trying to sort of replace whiteness in America. There's fears that we're trying to teach white kids to hate themselves so that they don't join the conversation and just sort of let power shift. And there's fear that this entire thing is just sort of like this Marxist Trojan horse that is going to take over the public schools from the inside.
Gloria, how should schools and districts respond to that kind of fear that, oh, you're out there indoctrinating our kids, when white parents freak out about that?
Well, I would tell you that public schools have an obligation to promote a set of, quote, American values. And that to me is the wonderful aspect of this work, is because if we go back to American values, we talk about equality, we talk about justice, and we can just fundamentally ask the question, is it just for us to have a criminal justice system that only allows those who have enough money to come out on, say, bail? Is it just that we are suspending kids who are Black and brown at a rate 4 to 5 more times greater than we would do for kids who are white? So to ask the fundamental question of justice and equality, and for schools to say, we're going to stand for these democratic values, I wouldn't waver from that. There is nothing democratic about racism.
Matt, I asked you about the experience of your white kids, but I'm curious, for the Black and brown and Indigenous kids you teach, what has their experience been like when you are having these conversations?
You know, the conversations I've had have given me the sense that my non-white students feel like the process of going through public school in a majority white city, it's like having to hold your breath through years and years and years, and you're just desperate to sort of get to the surface to get some air. And so kids tend to be relieved that we are finally having honest conversations about race, where we are describing it in the way it operates, and that we're not denying its existence and we're not denying their lived experiences. And so that's sort of been the sense that I get, is that once they trust me, it's like this, finally they hit the surface and there's this breath of fresh air, finally.
Matt, I want to talk about George Floyd's murder and Derek Chauvin's trial. It certainly changed the way a lot of white people think and talk about race. Did you change your curriculum?
I would say that I geared my curriculum towards this specific situation. So we were already talking about segregation, redlining, the way that sort of folks have access or don't have access to different opportunities, in the way that that leads to disparate outcomes. I was not talking so specifically about policing itself. Before the murder of George Floyd, I didn't have such a particular focus on policing. Since then, for example, a project that I just worked on, I conducted a series of interviews with all sorts of different people, the police chief. I talked to folks who were formerly incarcerated for decades. I talked to people doing prison reform, civil rights work. And we sort of conducted these interviews to sort of display all these different voices in the conversation, trying to help kids work towards empathy and understanding of this sort of this broader system at work.
You know, Gloria, Matt sounds like a pretty extraordinary teacher who kids are lucky to talk to. I wonder if you could speak a little more broadly about how teachers and school districts are generally attempting to modify their curriculum to deal with conversations around George Floyd's murder, around Black Lives Matter, and national conversations about race.
Well, I will tell you that Matt is indeed an exceptional teacher. He actually reminds me of another Matt, who is a former student of mine who teaches in North Carolina, who does some very similar things that he is doing. In general, I think teachers want to stay at arm's length with this topic. The parallel for me is whenever you start talking about sex education, right? Let's not talk about it. Schools shouldn't bring it up. And we act as if not talking about it means kids won't do it. Well, I think it's the same thing around race. Not talking about it means it's just going to go away. It is not going away. And I think we owe it to our young people to tell them the truth, to help them, give them the tools so they can research themselves and begin to discover some of the things that have put us in this particular position. I don't know that most students are having the experience that kids like Matt's students or like the students that I get to talk to in Carrboro, North Carolina. I think in general, we talk about it as something that used to be. So we put it in the context of slavery and the Civil War, and then we move on. And if you just look at the textbooks that our kids have access to, the essential narrative is we used to do that, but now we're better.
I'm wondering about that, actually, because textbooks obviously are a big thing here, and the sort of materials that school districts have. If you're a parent, Gloria, and you're listening to this, or your kid comes home with something and you think, that doesn't really match the experience of the country I live in, what can you do?
Well, I think that, you know, parents who are tuned into what's happening in schools and classrooms are willing to have a conversation. You know, Matt talked about the fact that his students, as well as his parents, trust him. And I've had that same experience as a parent and even as a grandparent, that I've had the opportunity to go to school and see for myself, not just assume that because it's in the textbook, that the teacher's not having kids interrogated, that the teacher's not having kids question it. I just had a conversation with a parent in Houston, and his daughter came home and said, "Dad, I don't understand this concept that we have in this book about the first Texans. They were actually referring to indigenous people. I cannot imagine an American Indian calling themselves, oh, we're the first Texans. No, we're the original people who lived here." So it's those kinds of things that textbooks promote because they have to get through committees to be able to be sold, that don't tell our kids authentic histories.
This is obviously a big talking point in conservative media. Matt, is that something that you've come up against either with parents or administrators or even other colleagues?
I mean, I would say that our administration has largely tried to be supportive of us as we navigate what is honestly a minefield. I can tell you that our community, the backlash in our community is growing. Unfortunately, a lot of the backlash is based off of untruths, even I would argue propaganda. So there's a series of things that thousands of parents in our district believe is happening that is not happening. And so the slogan of this counter movement has become anti-racism is racism. And I see posts every single day in these growing parent groups. They're building connections with one another. They're getting ready to endorse school board candidates and potentially run their own candidates. They're sending news to national conservative media. They've been on state radio. They're filming teachers because, you know, we teach on Zoom and in person at the same time. And so they are watching and in some circumstances filming their kids' teachers. They're fighting for legislation to ban critical race theory, although their definition of that is so broad that it would essentially exclude conversations about race. They want to ban the 1619 Project.
Based on the New York Times magazine project. Yeah,
that's correct. Right. And so it's a minefield because you have to find a way to be honest, to uphold the human dignity of every one of your students. We can't compromise on that, but also try to find some way to bring the community along and be like, listen, we're not indoctrinating your kids. We're trying to have a discussion.
Gloria, how would you respond to conservative critics who don't believe that race should play a role in the curriculum? And again, I want to underline white critics generally, because I think that, you know, for kids of color, race is there from day one.
Right. And you have the misfortune of having two social studies people on this conversation. As I'm listening to Matt talking about the organized opposition, one of the things that it reminds me of, you know, historians are going to be historians. And so I certainly take a historical look at this. It's like the Red Scare, that there's a communist everywhere. And so we got to watch everybody. We are literally performing that same kind of behavior with teachers and school districts around race. We are saying something's there that's not there. We're frightening people about whatever this is. And I think just trying to understand inequality is something that we owe our students. They need to begin, you know, we didn't murder George Floyd individually, but we witnessed it, and we witnessed it at a time in which we are all sort of hunkered down in our homes because of the pandemic. And so parents and community members had to provide an explanation because the students demanded it. Schools are perfectly set up to begin to uncover these issues, to begin to explore them. And why would we want our students to be ignorant? What I say to people when they say, well, that doesn't exist, there's no systemic racism, give me an explanation for the regular and predictable inequality that exists in health, in education, in employment, in housing, in criminal justice. Just what's the explanation? Now, some people will say, oh, well, it's class. Okay. Well, I can then disaggregate something like housing and banking and begin to show you that a working class white person is much more likely to get a loan than a middle class Black person. We need people to be able to have intelligent conversations about inequality in our society.
Gloria Ladson-Billings, Professor Emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and former Kellner Family Chair in Urban Education, and Matt Bockenfeld, a social studies teacher at Fishers High School in Fishers, Indiana. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
We've been discussing schools and the teaching of systemic racism, both past and present. And we wanted to hear from you. So we asked, were you taught about systemic racism in school? And if you have kids, how is racial equity in history being addressed in their education? Here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Julie in Orlando, Florida. And I was not taught about systemic racism in school because I went to school in the 70s. But my mom was wonderful, and she taught me to always be friends with anybody you liked, regardless of their skin color. I don't recall her saying the word racism to describe what she was trying to tell me about.
Hi, my name is Julie Bailey, New York, New York. And I believe the question was vis-a-vis being taught about systemic racism in school. And quite frankly, my answer is I was taught nothing. I am of a certain age, but I know I was taught nothing. I had to live it. I'm a Black child of immigrants growing up in America, and we learn about systemic racism through the school of hard knocks. Trust me, it's a school you never graduate from.
Hi, my name's Margaret, and I'm calling from Seattle. I didn't learn anything about racism in my very segregated schools in Scottsdale, Arizona in the 70s, which was ironic since it was less than a mile from the edge of the Pima Reservation, and on land that used to be in part of Mexico. We barely learned about anti-Semitism. We only learned about the Holocaust because a parent of a student came in and taught us that. It wasn't in the curriculum. My daughter went to an integrated school here in Seattle and learned a bit more about racism, but I would say that the learning that she got was very individualized and without nuance. And I believe that we need to talk about institutional racism all throughout our curriculum in histories, social studies, the arts, and literature.
This is Barbara calling from Denton. So I was homeschooled by white, deeply religious parents that had four bio kids and adopted three from Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. And on the one hand, my dad was great about educating us on the reason for the Civil War and the civil rights movement. But on the other hand, racism was treated as a problem of the past and systemic racism was not recognized. My parents believed that because they adopted black children, they basically can't possibly be racist. And they'll even say, we adopted black kids, we did our part, as if you could live in a state of arrival. Ironically, my mother has a habit of speaking about my adopted siblings with frustration that they're not like the bio kids, as in they don't act very white. So yeah.
The education I got about systemic racism while I was in grammar school was so immersive and subconscious that I didn't realize it until high school with my non-white classmates who challenged my perspective on everything. I'm John Clark from Wantagh, New York.
My name is Mercedes. I'm in Morristown, New Jersey. But I grew up outside the U.S. and was amazed when my kids started high school in the U.S. that all the U.S. history taught made minimal reference to how black people's contributions impacted the country favorably and seemed to minimize the crippling effects of slavery and Jim Crow.
Thanks, as always, for being part of the conversation. We love to hear from you. The number to call is 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE if you still have letters on your phone pads. Or you can send us a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.